It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
G'day, Mike Hussey here, but you can call me Mr. Supercoach. KFC Supercoach BBL is back and there's 25 grand up for grabs. So what are you waiting for? Play today at supercoach.com.au.
T's and C's apply. New South Wales authorisation number TP/01005.
Across court forehand, passing shot from Rafael Nadal is sublime. Ridiculous, sublime, amazing.
Forehand down the line has been operating well for Medvedev. Now he plays a drop shot out of nowhere. Oh. It is lethal. Woo. Back in down the line, winner for Medvedev.
Oh, how good was that?
I mean, how good was this? Shut the front door. Even my co-commentator thought that was impressive. Nice. That was circa 1980, wasn't it?
Super.
A little bit of serve volley.
Love it.
Just when we thought serve volley might become unfashionable, like rollerblades and gluten.
Medvedev goes up the line, another winner. Right on the line. How about that? And he looks across to Jill Savara and he says, we've done it again. We've found a way.
I don't know if I should call it this way, but he's like a perfect guy, you know? Never, when you ask him why he doesn't break a record, like there's always a story about the controller when he was young and Tony told him that you shouldn't do it. And I mean, it's tough, you know? I know many of my friends who break controllers, you know, who don't even play tennis, but people can get mad at many things. And I feel like, yeah, Rafa is amazing for this. And yeah, I have not much to add. I mean, he's just amazing about this.
Rafa onto the forehand. Now deep from Rafa, cross court, Berrettini nets it. And Rafael Nadal is in the final of the Australian Open for the sixth time. His quest for 21 Grand Slams continues.
For me, it's amazing, and I'm super happy to be able to compete for the last 3 weeks at the level that I am doing. Not only about tennis, not that for sure. It's surprising for me to be able to play at the level that I am playing. But in terms of just compete and play tennis at the high level again, facing the most important players of the world, for me, it's something unbelievable. No? As I said, but I am not lying. And I'm not creating a history, you know. 1 month and a half, I don't know if I will be able to be back to the tour because we were not able to solve any problem. Here I am, and thanks life for it.
Following 13 days of elite tennis competition, the Australian Open has reached its end. A fortnight which has twisted and rotated between storylines off the court to the happenings on the courts and culminating in one of the best results for the home nation in decades. And now tonight, the final stanza. One more match remains. Tonight is the men's final and history, as always, is on the line. Daniil Medvedev is the highest ranked player in the draw, the champion of the last US Open. Could he be the first man to win a second slam title in the very next major after achieving his first? The weight of history tonight sits on the shoulders of Rafael Nadal. The race to 21 could end. Will it be third time lucky? Federer tried and failed in 2019. Djokovic tried and failed in 2021. Can Nadal be the man in 2022? In a matter of hours, we'll know. Around Australia on SEN, this is the men's final of the 2022 Oz Open. For the super fast charging all-electric Kia EV6 and for McDonald's, try the Aussie Angus Burger at Macca's today. Good evening. Welcome into Melbourne Park. Rod Laver Arena is set and ready to go. The women's doubles final has ended in a thrilling finish with Barbora Krejcikova and Katerina Siniakova, the Czech pair, taking out the title against Danilina from Kazakhstan and Beatriz Haddad-Maia from Brazil. It's good to be in your company for the next couple of hours. We are in the build-up now to the men's singles final. Jordan Canellos with you. Brett Phillips will take you through the majority of the night once he is done with his emceeing duties on Rod Laver Arena. But alongside me for the pre-game here at RLA is from the New York Times, leading tennis writer worldwide, Christopher Clary. Chris, good evening.
Hey, good evening to you.
How are you feeling ahead of this final tonight? What a contest we have to finish off AO 2022.
doing.
Yeah, I was talking to Lawrence before this thing started, and we kind of agree we're going to follow the Rafa approach and not worry about the numbers of days we've been doing or anything. We're the number of titles. We're just going to just do it point by point.
Yeah, I think if we looked too hard into the numbers and how many hours we're here, I think we'd shock even ourselves.
No focus on 21 or day 14 here. We're just going to go with the moment.
Absolutely. We've just witnessed the women's singles. The women's doubles final here on Rod Laver Arena, which ended just a moment ago. You can hear in the background the acceptance speech is happening right now. And that was a great contest as well. It went three sets. It went over 2 hours. And it ended with a thrilling match and championship point. So it's every final here has just had a thrilling climax.
Yeah, and that match there, Barbora Krejcikova and Katerina Siniakova have been the doubles team in women's tennis for a while now, and that was their first Australian Open victory together, and now they hold the Olympic title as well, which they won last year, and they've won 3 of the 4 majors, and the one they're missing is kind of Barty-esque now. They're missing the U.S. Open.
Yes.
So that's all they need to do to finish up what they've got to achieve in the old Grand Slam count.
The last one. Doubles is, just to touch on this for a second, doubles has almost been rejuvenated a little bit here at the Oz Open. I think, well, certainly from an Australian perspective, a lot of attention has been redirected back to doubles for the first time in years, maybe decades, really, with the pairing of Kokkinakis and Kyrgios winning last night, Edwin and Purcell, Max Purcell reaching his second Oz Open doubles final in 3 years. But these contests that we've had, full stadiums out on the show courts around the grounds, it's really brought a lot of hubbub to the doubles scene, which is great.
I agree with you. I think it's a really undervalued, you know, part of pro tennis. For a lot of reasons, some of them understandable, some of them less so. But I think Australia has such a tradition in doubles, and they have had so many people who've been, you know, real figures in that part of the game. You know, go last night on the court, you had Mark Woodford and Todd Woodbridge, the Woodies that were there. It goes way back. So it's great to see the revival here, and I think it's all the more important because some of these team events that have been a venue and a forum for doubles in over the last 50, 60 years have really kind of, doubles has lost its main spot in those events like Davis Cup now.
Yeah.
So it needs a way to get it back out there again. But ultimately, it's a star-driven thing. In the U.S., we had the Bryan brothers for a long time, for 20 years. Those guys hit a certain demographic and really became stars in our country through doubles. But it takes a consistent sort of appearance, a consistent commitment to it. If Nick Kyrgios and Tanasi wanted to play doubles together regularly, I think that could be the kind of team that could break out and do that.
Yeah.
Will they? I don't think so. That doesn't seem to be their plan.
Is there scope for singles players? Is there enough time for singles players to commit to playing doubles as well if they wanted to do it, if they wanted to almost juggle the two formats evenly, but you know, between their schedules?
Yeah, the last guy to be number one in both was Yevgeny Kafelnikov of Russia. That was about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So the way the modern game has gone, right, you know, the best of 5 sets, commitment, you know, over a 2-week period in a long season, the top guys have weighed that one, measured that one, and decided no. I wouldn't say it's impossible if you can do it on your off days and they somehow, you know, keep it to best of 3 sets and doubles. Wimbledon's obviously tough, still best of 5 on the men's side on doubles.
Yeah.
But, you know, that it is a problem for sure. But even if we can get it going in the ATP events, make it more possible, like Indian Wells, for example, they always get a pretty good field there because of the way it's structured. Maybe have a way for the ATP to encourage more of the stars. And there's a guy like Kyrgios who's maybe not going to be a Grand Slam singles champ, but is a huge personality in tennis and has so much to bring to the sport and all that he can add to it. Maybe doubles could be a venue for him.
Yeah.
On top of the singles.
So we look ahead to the final tonight now, the men's singles final. One more match to go here. Every other discipline has been run and won, from the juniors to the wheelchairs to the quad wheelchairs, the doubles and the women's singles final. And now Rafael Nadal and Daniil Medvedev is the last match we have out on court. That will get underway in about an hour and a half from now on Rod Laver Arena. Tonight's match, how perfectly does it fit in to be the final match of this year's tournament?
Well, you know what? I love intergenerational duels like this. And frankly, if you're Medvedev and you're trying to make a name for yourself in a crowded global sports marketplace, I mean, what's the best opportunity you have? It's beating the established superstars like Novak Djokovic or Nadal, and Federer is not playing now, but he's in that category too. And here he is. This is his second swing at it now. And he had Novak in a U.S. Open final last year. He won that one, and I think that raised his profile. Now he's got Nadal. Again, he can be the spoiler for 21. He's still starting out his career, but that's a big sort of attention getter in that sense. So I think this is a huge chance for him. And obviously in terms of Nadal, at this stage of his career, I'm always amazed. I feel like as a tennis writer in the past, the guys who just won and won and won, at the end, the public was kind of tired of it.
Yeah.
And so let's bring on the new generation. Let's go. This is different. People are still kind of wanting to see Nadal win again. They want to see Federer win again. And there's actually a certain part of the world, maybe not right now as much as before, but wants Djokovic to win some more too. So it's an interesting dynamic because of their rivalry among themselves. People are still wanting to see them progress. I think Nadal's got a lot of sentimental energy behind him tonight.
Yeah.
Does he have the energy is the question.
Yeah, there seems to be a lot of sentiment and emotion with Rafael Nadal, and a lot of that has stemmed from his comeback, firstly. It didn't look like for months last year that he would even return to playing tennis. He said in a recent press conference that he considered retiring. We saw the emotion on the court from Rafael Nadal as soon as he won his semi-final to win a place in tonight's match. He was in tears, and I think he is maybe overcome by his own efforts. Maybe there's a lot of pride there, rightly so as well. A good dose of pride, a healthy dose of pride for Rafael Nadal and what he's been able to do to get to tonight's final. So there's a lot of different things mixing about there. There's the comeback and then there is history. It's the race to 21. We've been sitting on Djokovic 20, Federer 20, Nadal 20 for a while now. They've each had chances to get to number 20 and have failed in their most recent attempts. Djokovic winning, almost doing the Grand Slam last year. He notched up three and then fell at the last hurdle against Daniil Medvedev at the US. But Rafael Nadal, how badly does he want to be the first to 21?
You know, I'm not sure it really drives him. That's the thing that's funny. And you could say he's sort of talking it down, and it's a good tactic to take the pressure off or to, in a sense, not develop too much of an animus with his big rivals. But having heard him talk about his whole arc of his career over the years, I think he means it. Yeah, for sure, he'd love to be the guy at the end with the most. But that really isn't, I think, his mission statement. Novak, I think it matters more to him, and he's made that pretty clear. Nadal, I'm not sure how much he's downplaying it. I think he's a guy who really just feels like to be able to compete and be out here point by point, match by match is where his true pleasure and his true drive comes from. And maybe it's also his way of thinking he will succeed because it's worked for him so far throughout his career, not to put too much focus on these numbers, which have been insane at times. The French Open numbers have been just surreal. And he's had to answer questions about that surrealism forever. And he's probably learned to sort of where that fits into his perspective. But I really don't get the sense that it's 21 that's driving him as much as it is to just prove to himself that he can still compete at the highest level.
Yeah, so primarily it's just Nadal wants to play tennis to play tennis and just to be out there competing. He's a competitor.
I think it's true. I think from watching him over the years, he seems like he's at his happiest, not when the match is over, but when he's out there being able to fight for each point. I think that's really what gives him the greatest pleasure.
Yeah. And Daniil Medvedev, so you said before he wants to be the spoiler. He said himself on a post-match on-court interview that he wants to be the one who denies one of these big three the number 21 again. He doesn't mind. He's a very personable guy. When you hear him speak in his on-court interviews, in his post-match press conferences, he's a good character. He's humorous. He's got a sense of sort of humanity. He sort of, you know, he's polite. But he probably doesn't mind being the villain tonight.
Yeah, he's a, you know, I don't know if he's a small cat, but he's an interesting cat.
Very good, yeah.
That's for sure. And that's great. Tennis needs interesting cats.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how many small cats it needs. But anyway, he's definitely somebody who I think is going to be fascinating to watch grow in this global role and sport that he's taking. And he seems to be the kind of guy, if he stays healthy physically and is able to maintain that, I think he'll be around for a while because he's got so many tools in the toolbox and what he can do. And that big wingspan, he runs like a deer. I mean, it's just a lot of stuff going on that's positive out there. So I think he's around for a while. And he hasn't even really figured out clay and grass yet. And here he is on the brink of number one, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But I just feel like, as an individual, I'm sort of fascinated to see how it all comes together for him. And I can tell you, I live in France, you know, part of the year, and he's been down in southern France training for a lot of his professional career. The guy speaks great French.
Really?
Really, really good French.
Wow.
I mean, so he's going to have a way to reach parts of the tennis audience and marketplace that other guys, much like Federer, who's also truly, you know, a bilingual sort of person, and that way trilingual in a way. Well, Daniil's French is great, and he's a guy who's got a quirky, sort of fearless personality. Exactly. And I have to tell you this. We asked him a lot of questions Like after that outburst the other night in the match, which was pretty brutal and not a good look at all. I think he went way too far and shouting and lecturing the chair umpire like that. It wasn't a good look. But when he was asked about it, he did not in any way back off the responsibility for that. He took it, said, I don't feel good about it. It bothers me. I regret it. I've been working on myself. I got a ways to go. And he just did a good job of handling a question about his own behavior that some athletes might have gotten edgy about. I've seen that numerous times with him.
Do you think the general public understands Daniil Medvedev? Do you think so that the tennis tour, it flitters around from city to city, country to country, all year round? It's, depending on time zones, particularly for us here in Australia, watching other tournaments around the world, it's always late at night, middle of the night. So the general sports public here in Australia, I can't speak for other countries, but here in Australia, gets a big healthy dose of tennis players at this time of year. For the rest of the year, it's sort of in and out at majors whenever it's hitting the mainstream headlines. So with that nature of tennis being like that, do you think Daniil Medvedev is understood by sports fans the world over?
No, I don't think so at all yet. I think it's definitely a work in progress, and I'm not even sure Daniil Medvedev understands Daniil Medvedev completely yet. I think he's figuring that out as well in terms of his new stature and where he fits in and all these sorts of things. I think of the Grand Slam audiences, the New York persona, the perception of him is probably the most solidified now.
Yeah.
Because I think people remember 2019, the year he lost to Nadal in the final, how he sort of turned a tough New York crowd around a little bit by sort of, he was acting up. Crowd started to boo him, got on him. He sort of says, bring it on, I want more of it. And sort of said, you guys helped me by being against me. Thank you, everything else. So he kind of was in the face of the New York crowd. And ultimately, I think the New Yorkers respect that, the way things are. And he basically, by the end of the tournament, had totally turned them around. They were in his pocket. Now, he hasn't done anything quite similar to that. But, people who follow the sport in the U.S., how many guys are going to win their first Slam championship and be a dead fish, on their celebration on the? Yeah. So everybody knows he's a bit quirky and different. So I think there's that sort of thing is solidified. But I think outside of that, I don't think people have a clear understanding of what they're up against or what they're going to get for the next few years.
One of the great celebrations, that one, from Medvedev last year. The match itself, and we'll talk about and dissect this match and how it might play out. But in a nutshell, what styles are we seeing? So to maybe a tennis newbie, what's Nadal going to bring? What's Medvedev going to bring? And how are they going to clash when they're in battle?
Well, the big question is, what are we going to see in terms of what their own choices are going to be? Because the A games have some similarities. They're both returning from absurdly deep positions in the court. Sometimes you have a hard time spotting them because they're so far back as they return. You go, is somebody out there or not? I can't quite tell. And they both love, they have huge, what we call in tennis, shot tolerance, meaning they can hang out in a long rally and be very comfortable there for a long time and have the confidence that when they want to accelerate, they can. And in different ways, they both rely on serve. Nadal's serve is nowhere near as big as Medvedev. Medvedev is 6'6" and can just slap huge serves in all kinds of parts of the court and has a very quick rhythm. But they both rely on the serve to set up their next shot when they're on the serving position. So those are the A games. But in New York, when they played in 2019 in the U.S. Open Final, which is the best one to compare to this because it's an outdoor hard court and similar sort of best-of-five setting, they both went to B game, C game, because they had to, because the two A games were almost Medvedev was down two sets. The A games weren't working for him, so he went into more of an attack mode and started coming to net. And then Rafa decided he had to respond, so he started doing more of that himself. And by the end, their numbers of net rushes were very, very high. So I'll be very curious tonight in the situation where it's like, he knows that I know that he knows what I'm going to do, what they will decide to do as the match progresses. Because they're both good tacticians, and they both have a lot of options. And their games, I think, match up interestingly because Nadal, as we all know, and as Denis Shapovalov pointed out the other day, is very deliberate. It's kind of a ponderous sort of style when he's out there at times. It's all reflection before the action. And Medvedev, when you watch him, you almost got to slow him down. It's like, bang, 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 serve, serve, serve. And even though the points can last a long time, the pace is different. So that could be a source of frustration to both of them tonight to be playing at different paces like that.
Yeah, Nadal is very much, he'll try and break down the opposition's game. He's I don't know if this has to do with age or whether this has just been something he's always focused on from a young part of his career, but he will try and pick apart what the opposition is doing and find the weakness and end the point. And that's what Daniil Medvedev is going to have to deal with from his side of the court, but he can deal with it. We know he can because He's dealt with a lot that's come his way. He's dealt with the best in the world, and it's got him up to number two in the world right now. And it's not next week, I don't think, but potentially a tournament later, he will get to number one with the rankings. So even if he wins tonight, Medvedev, I think he stays at number two, but it'll be shortly after that he could climb up to world number one, which should be, in itself, that's going to be a momentous occasion. When was the last time someone not named Roger, Rafael or Novak was world number one?
Andy Murray.
Yes.
Andy Murray was, yeah. And he was for a little while, for sure, before his hip gave out. It's almost a sure thing, it looks like to me. I mean, there's a lot of ifs in the scenarios for number one. But Medvedev has to win tonight, obviously. That's only if he wins. If he doesn't win, things are up in the air for quite a while longer. But if he wins, basically, if neither he nor Djokovic play in the next 3 weeks, which I think is probably a likely scenario based on what Novak is talking about, then Daniil takes over on February 21st as number one.
Yep.
Novak could add something to his schedule before, or Medvedev might play Rotterdam where he's still entered on February 7th. If he wins that, basically then he's kind of guaranteed to go to that spot. But I think either way, if he wins tonight, if Medvedev beats Nadal, then I think it's going to be his.
What is the immediate future for Novak Djokovic look like? Just to digress for a second, what's his schedule like, and is his schedule even solidified with his status?
It's not solidified. He's entered in Dubai. The ATP has confirmed that he plans to play. I don't think he's confirmed that yet, but it makes some sense. That would sort of be his normal schedule, and obviously he didn't get to play here, so he's probably eager for matches and eager to kind of get back to playing tennis at probably a less sort of floodlit venue than a Grand Slam would be, or Dubai is sort of protected, tucked away in that sense. And I think he can get in there as an unvaccinated person without a whole lot of difficulty from what I've been hearing. But after that, his normal cycle would be to play the big events in the U.S., outdoor hard courts, Indian Wells and Miami. And I think right now, as far as I know, he can't get in, because unless he's got some sort of exemption issue like he had in Australia, you cannot get into the U.S. as an unvaccinated foreigner unless you have an exemption. And as far as we can tell, he doesn't qualify. So I think he's not going to be able to come to the U.S. unless he gets vaccinated.
Wow. Jay, it could be, I mean, that's the personal story. And then the tennis story as well is he's going to drop points, that means. So.
Yeah, hard choices.
And the effects that has on his career thereafter.
Yeah, it really is. It's a signpost moment for him. And, you know, like in the past, you know, wars and acts of nature of things that have affected tennis players and athletes' careers. Mm. This is his situation. You can say it's his fault because he's got a decision to make. But if he's committed to that, it's going to be kind of a force beyond tennis that's going to change his career.
That's the voice of Christopher Clary from the New York Times. He is here in our first hour of the pregame ahead of the men's singles final, Rafael Nadal and Daniil Medvedev, which is set to get underway in just over an hour from now. SEN's coverage of the Australian Open brought to you by the super fast charging all-electric Kia EV6. Jordan Canellis with you, but not for much longer, because Brett Phillips, after the break, is going to step into the bunker and take you through the remainder of the pre-match. That's next, coming up on SEN.
I hear that she's learnt her slice backhand from her first coach at a very young age, which, you know, she's now using unbelievably offensively and, you know, dismantling players' games. But so it is the variety. She would seem that she's done a lot of hard work on a serve because the serve is faster and the placement is better, and then she follows it up with her big forehand. But it all culminates with her attitude and to put it all together, to bring it all together, and I think that's what she does so well. She looks calm, she looks confident, she looks happy.
Yep.
So, look, I'm really hoping that, you know, that will be the same tonight.
Seeing her play from a young age, I mean, she had every shot already. She could already hit a slice backhand, she could hit, you know, a topspin kick serve, you know, she could hit everything. And, her weapons have just kept growing and growing and growing as those years have gone on.
It's up the middle. There goes that backhand. It is lethal. This crowd willing her tonight to be the first Australian Open champion at home since 1978. Big serve up the tee, right through Collins. It's a bit of deja vu of the first six matches. Crowd on their feet, loving what they're seeing. Look at a second here. She steps right up just inside that baseline, takes on the backhand, whipped across court. Ash just makes it over. Forehand cross court by Collins, puts up the lob, Barty. Collins will track it just in, and then she went the big overhead, and there's the first bit of real Danielle Collins outward emotion. Ash ready to go, runs around, takes on the forehand, whips across court,
It's long from Collins. Here's another chance to break. Miss backhand from Collins. Barty's broken again.
And now serving
out wide for an ace to the ad side. Five games all. What a recovery. Have a look at this crowd. You can hear them.
They're on their feet.
The world. Cross-court forehand wide. Wide by Collins. Four championship points for Ash Barty. Now Collins will put the serve into play to the Barty chip return up the middle. Collins went cross-court the backhand. Ash digs it out. Collins looking to go up the line. Ash on the forehand. Cross-court. She's done it. She's done it. Ash Barty has broken the drought of 44 years. She is the Australian Open champion. What a moment to save her.
Oh, that is a... Thank God for Casey Delacroix.
Wow.
I'm speechless. That is just... You can't be speechless on radio, but I really am. This is just an incredible moment.
Yeah, it's goosebumps.
I mean, this is just a dream come true for me, and I'm so proud to be an Aussie. So thank you so much, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, it was pretty special to be in the box here last night. Great to listen back to some of the excitement, the exhilaration of an Australian winning at home. I was at Wimbledon the year Andy Murray broke the long drought, and that is one of the biggest roars I've ever heard out of SW19. And I thought, how good would it be to be standing vertical and be in good health and see an Australian actually win the Australian Open. Fantastic last night. Ash Barty getting the job done against Danielle Collins. Brett Phillips jumping in with Christopher Cleary. It's great to have you here, Chris. I know you've been sort of previewing a bit of Nadal and Medvedev. I've just watched a fantastic women's doubles final. We've just been out there for the presentation, and Krejcikova and Siniaková win their fourth Grand Slam doubles title, twice at Roland Garros, Wimbledon, now here. But boy, oh boy, did they have to work overtime today against a pairing. Isn't it great double? Sometimes, you know, a pairing can just come together who have both played on the tour for a little while, had sort of mixed success. Anna Danilina's hardly played on the, you know, the WTA tour. She's played a lot on the ITF with our very own Arina Rodionova last year, and they collect a nice little prize, win the Sydney Classic, make the final. I mean, sometimes you just can't predict where your fortunes are going to go.
Look at these two Aussie players I heard about, this guy named Kyrgios and this guy named Kokkinakis, yes, too, you know?
Yeah.
Not a lot of Grand Slam doubles in their past together. No. And here they go. Boom, yeah.
Yeah, no, it was fantastic. And well done to Barbora and Katerina. They've been lifelong friends since they were at a young age in the Czech Republic. It's great watching doubles when you've got a pair who play so much together, just the nuances of the tennis court, their communication. But they had to pull out all stops today. But I'd love your reflection on Ash Barty from a non-Australian point of view. I mean, she's got universal love and admiration for her game and her as a person, but just take us back to your own thoughts from last night.
You know, as an outsider, I was in, as you talked about Andy Murray and Britain in that moment there, and it hadn't been as long for both because Virginia Wade had obviously had won at some point too in there, but it definitely was, for me, you want for the country to have the right athlete when you've had that long a wait.
Correct.
You want to have sort of the marriage of the person and the moment.
Yes.
And I just got the sense that that was really just the right person to do that. There obviously been a lot of great candidates over the years.
Mm.
Pat Rafter was so beloved. You had Leighton Hewitt, Pat Cash, Sam Stosur. They've all won Grand Slam singles titles outside of Australia.
Mm.
But it just seems like Ash, having watched her rise as an outsider and seeing how much she resonates with Australians, really kind of across all demographics and sort of what the country clearly means to her and how much strength she takes from being here.
Yep.
You can just tell by the way she's made her choices about her scheduling and everything else during these tough periods. It seemed like everything came together last night. And you could feel it, that people were sort of willing her across the finish line and that she took strength from that, even though you couldn't necessarily tell from her expressions. You could see it in her game that she was getting lifted by that energy. And it was beautiful. I got goosebumps as an outsider too, and I was flashing back. I mean, I don't know if you were there too, Brett, but the Sydney Olympics, closest equivalent for me, I was in the stadium, you know, in was an Olympic stadium then in Homebush. Well,
I wasn't at the Sydney Olympics, but I felt like I was there. I know what you're going to refer to. I'll let you.
Yeah, no, it was the Kathy Freeman moment.
Yeah. Yep.
And I had, as a New York Times reporter, then I'd gotten to know Kathy a bit before the event, so I'd really talked to her a lot about what it meant. And that one, there's a lot of equivalence in a way. I guess the difference is that Kathy had one chance.
Mm.
You know, that was the Olympics in Sydney, in her country. It wasn't going to happen again. She wasn't going to be the world's best 400-meter runner again at that moment.
Yep.
So she had one lap. So it was really a crushing pressure. And at that point, it was such an awakening moment for Indigenous rights in Australia and everything else. And she was such an important figure in all that. So that, I think the crushing weight was really on Kathy in a way that it wasn't on Ash, who would have another chance next year and the year after to play the Australian Open. But still, it was, you know, a woman's athlete, groundbreaking in some ways with connections to Australia's present and its heritage, and a very popular figure. And I think also in a way vulnerable, Brett, in the way that she projects herself, and that you can see that it ain't easy for Ash all the time out there, you know? She doesn't show you the emotion, but I mean, I don't think she played her best tennis last night, nor did she at Wimbledon, but she keeps finding a way, which shows a lot of strength. I mean, she's 3-0 in Grand Slam finals now. So those are my basic sort of riffs on that. But it's cool to have been in Sydney for Kathy's moment and to have been here for Ash's.
Well, I mean, you go back, Chris, don't you, through great champions, and you know, think of Serena, in the 23 she's won, the adversity that she's faced throughout tournaments. I can just think of matches here at the Australian Open when it's looked like Serena's done, on the canvas, about to be out, and she's somehow fought through and come from a set down and a match points against her and got through and actually won the whole thing. So that's what always intrigues me, is the mind and the inner workings of these athletes that, you know, we're trying to make judgments from the outside. We'd love to be inside their little bubble and how they go about it. But they've got a special quality that they fight. They believe they can come back from any position. They back their game. But I must say, I was sitting here with Sam last night. We wrote off that second set, and it was sort of, even though it was a nervous time, you sort of wanted Ash to be challenged at some point in this tournament. But for her to turn that around and just keep playing the next point, the next point, the next point, and building the pressure, and gee, that crowd, whatever it's worth, we can never totally measure it, just wheeled her home and added that 1% or 2%.
And I think it's nice that this one didn't come first, you know. She got the chance to win that French, which is kind of a surprise. Wimbledon, we all know the resonance that has worldwide and to Australians. But obviously for her to get the chance to kind of build up the anticipation for this, struggle a bit, frankly, here in some of her matches in recent years to kind of play her best tennis under the pressure, and to come through it and to give everybody that moment. And also, you know, great, Yvonne Goolagong is able to come. I mean, during the pandemic, it's been tricky. I know she's had some health issues for her to be there and give that kind of closure to it and have that symbolic finish.
It was a beautiful touch.
Yeah, exactly. Very nice.
I was thinking when it happened that we should have maybe known something like that was probably being in the works behind the scenes, just because how tight Yvonne and Ash are. It's a genuine, beautiful friendship. And, you know, Yvonne's so passionate about Indigenous kids in this country. Not just tennis. If they take up tennis, that's great, but just a better life for Indigenous kids. But pretty much stays out of the limelight. You won't see Yvonne doing many radio interviews or TV interviews. Mm. She'll do some requests here and there, but if it's Ash Barty, well, she'll do anything.
I wouldn't be surprised if Ash Barty, when she's in her 60s and 70s, is sort of similar. You know,
yeah.
I'm not sure that Ash is somebody who needs to have all that attention and focus on her.
Not at all.
So it'll be interesting to see. It's going to be a good thing to be Ash Barty the next 50, 60 years in Australia, I think, though, huh?
Yes. She's blessed, absolutely blessed. A word on Danielle Collins, who steps inside the top 10 for the first time when the official rankings come out tomorrow. I mean, she will look at that as, you know, an opportunity. I mean, people can say, you know, she had nothing to lose, but, I mean, she might never, ever have the chance to get back to a Grand Slam final. Some people have the narrowest of windows, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, look at Sofia Kenin, who won here in pretty spectacular fashion in 2020 and looked like she was ready to be a consistent player. Now we just don't know. She's had personal problems and not playing the same level anymore, and things can change. So, or Emma Raducanu, not in any way saying it won't happen for her again, but see how things can change from that dominant, not losing a single set at the U.S. Open, and then having trouble winning a match on tour since then in the few tournaments that she's played. So it can change. Danielle strikes me as somebody who's very driven, has a good plan, and I think she, as she's pointed out in some of her interviews here, she's somebody who's taken a lot of responsibility for all the details of her career now, and she's doing a lot of her own coaching. Not because she can't find a coach. I think it's because that's what she's, the decision she's made to do that at this point. And doing a lot of the analytics work and analysis of things on her own. And she has a very powerful modern game, and that returning aggressively, cutting off the angles, got a pretty good serve, runs well, and competes. So I don't think it's going to be the last we'll hear of her at this level. But I was heartened to see her image has been sort of in some ways a bit negative until now, and that people sort of see her as this very aggressive, in-your-face kind of player, maybe a little rough around the edges. And then you hear her give a speech like last
night.
Or the news conferences that she's done here.
Yep.
I mean, she's a university grad, and you can tell. I mean, she's definitely she was actually a major in communication, so we shouldn't be that surprised. But she definitely, I think, especially in Australia, really raised her profile in a positive way. And unfortunately, this happens in the middle of the night in the U.S. I'm not sure it really hit mainstream U.S. culture. But if she hits it big in the U.S. At a tournament, I wouldn't be surprised to see people really start warming to her.
It's hard not to sort of like her just from a pure competitive sense. I mean, you love players that... or athletes, so just get the absolute best and get into a zone and compete. I love that. I love a little bit of the rah-rah and the aggressive outward emotion. So, yeah, look forward to seeing what she can do for the remainder of 2022. Just off the text, winner of the male Aussie Open should jump in the Yarra wearing a Fitzroy Guernsey. Thank you, Mario. Maslin Beach over there in Adelaide. Fitzroy being my old club, Chris, in footy here, AFL. So that tends to get a few little mentions. Fitzroy, good Guernsey too, so... Get all right on Rafa. Those biceps are bulging. The feedback we had last night was absolutely brilliant. I received all these additional texts today. The power of radio, Chris, where people were listening to that call who mightn't have been able to get in front of a TV, was captivating. So we want that to continue tonight for Rafa and Daniil. You know the number, 0433 98 11 16. Right throughout the night, share where you are, how you're watching the final, your thoughts on the final, anything else you're doing while you're multitasking. A lot of people were multitasking last night while listening to our call. In fact, people had to pull over who were driving listening to our call because they could not hold the steering wheel. They were shaking, that nervous about Ash Barty getting over the line. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. Our build-up to the men's final. They're just preparing Rod Laver Arena with the roof closed, the light show. There'll be a special performance, national anthem, and then, of course, it'll be, I think, Rod Laver and also Jim Courier coming out with the Sir Norman Brooks Challenge Cup ahead of Rafa, trying to win 21. Daniil Medvedev trying to win his second and his first Australian Open. Back with more here from Melbourne Park. Welcome back. Rod Laver Arena ahead of the men's final coming up tonight between Rafael Nadal and also Daniil Medvedev. It is the calm before the storm. We're going to have a full house here at Rod Laver in his own house, along with all the dignitaries and celebrities. Some A-grade celebrities, some a little bit further down the chain, Chris, who when they, you know, they put out that sheet every day, you know, faces in the crowd. I can't identify all of them, but you've got to sort of be across lots of different things and TV shows, and but you can become a celebrity quite easily these days, can't you?
Well, I wouldn't know, but yeah, I mean, that's interesting.
Well, the word celebrity.
Is the seating chart based on that in the old president's box there? Do they kind of scale you up based on what your Twitter follower account is or your Instagram follower account?
A little closer to the front if you're gaining a little bit of traction. 0433 98 11 16 on the text tonight. That's how you can communicate with us right throughout the night. We were just talking about Ash Barty and Daniil Collins reflecting on that final last night. I know, Chris, you sent out a tweet today of a country of, what, 25.5 million people. Gee, there were a few eyeballs on Ash Barty last night.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell me, Brett, what this means. I'll let you share it. I don't really know what the context is.
Well, a peak audience of 4.261 million, an average audience of 3.577 million. So that to me is, well, if you go to a peak of 4.26, I can't think of a sporting event or, like, I mean, obviously AFL here, NRL, we've got State of Origin, other big events. Some are obviously right across the season, some are one-off. But 4.26, I don't know if I've heard a sporting event go to that level. So that is massive.
Yeah, I know she got some good ratings here for Wimbledon, even though that was not great times in terms of the time changes and everything. And the early matches here have been very good, too. But that's a new level. And my question sort of as an outsider is, like, who the heck wasn't watching?
Correct.
Why couldn't they go much higher than they should have? You should have. It's kind of a national moment, right?
Well, I go back to years ago when the Socceroos qualified for the World Cup for the first time in, how long was that, about 30, 40 years, I can't remember exactly, but yeah, I think it was about the 70s when John Aloisi gave Australia victory and did the lap of honour, and I think about 80,000 up at ANZ Stadium, and millions, no one was not watching that particular moment, because it had been such a long time that the Socceroos had been at the World Cup. So yeah, it's great to reflect and remember sort of where you were and these significant moments. Is there anything better, Chris? We you know, you and I love sport, the theatre of live sport.
No, I think that's right. And that especially when you reach somebody young with a moment like that. The kids that are around the country here or around the world who are holding tennis rackets in their hands already or thinking about it, and then they watch something like that, that really puts you in a different place in terms of the choices that you make. And that's where you can make a big impact down the road. I mean, look at our country and the players that have come into the sport, and not just our country, around the world, with Serena and Venus Williams, for example.
Yep.
The number of people that have been brought to the game by Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic over the last 20 years. But I'm really curious now, Brett, about Ash, because, for example, that victory last night was obviously a huge deal in Australia. Just look at the numbers. Mm. Anybody who was here knows it was a goosebump moment. But I wonder, I don't think it penetrated in my country, for example. Not that that's important, but it is interesting as she tries to grow as an international. She has the skill, the talent, and now the resume, the CV, to be able to be an international superstar.
Yep.
But I really wonder, will that last night really boosted her because of the time that it was in the night, middle of the night in the U.S. and the fact we're getting less coverage this year than we have in the past? I don't know about Europe and other places. I'd be fascinated to see in the next 3 to 4 months what kind of impact it had on her profile globally, not just in Australia.
I mean, will she ever gain that real traction, just the type of person she is? I mean, she's humble, quiet achiever. I mean, she's not out there as a flamboyant athlete in terms of expression on the court. And then, you know, when she's got a microphone in hand, she's not saying anything outlandish or anything that draws attention to her. It's methodical, practical. She's going about her business. So, I mean, she's probably never going to get that total sort of, you know, global presence to outdo. I mean, in your country, obviously, it's tough for tennis anyway, isn't it? When you've got the four big codes
who
dominate. When does tennis get the biggest cut through, Chris, and maybe upstage those four big sports?
Well, I can tell you, I mean, it's for a sport that has struggled a little bit to get its niche in terms of audiences when it's being played, it sure has produced a lot of big stars, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Naomi Osaka in the U.S. is big.
Yeah.
I mean, she's also been in the U.S. for quite a long time, but it's really not about that. It's more just because of her social justice, social media presence, and just the image that she projects. Yeah, I mean, she's big.
Mm.
She's already up there, and you can tell from the commercial interests that are there. I think with Ash, you know, Ash isn't unlike a Nadal type personality in some ways. You know, I wouldn't say Rafa's a controversial figure.
No.
I mean, what it may take with Ash is that sort of rivalry aspect. She may need to have players come along that become maybe the antithesis of Ash Barty, maybe a wild, crazy person who's going to be the contrast. And then people will sort of pick their camp, you know. I like Ash because she's got that dignity to her, and she doesn't show those emotions that way, and she's classy. Maybe that's going to be what it takes. But right now, when she's kind of on her own and there aren't really any great rivalries in the women's game.
No, I was about to say that.
It's a real problem.
I can't quite see looking at the crystal ball, where they're going to come from.
Well, you know, maybe someone like Coco Gauff comes along from the younger generation and starts to play that level. Or maybe it's Naomi Osaka stabilizes and makes the great quest in her game to be a great clay court and grass court player.
That's the one we want. We want Osaka and Barty going head-to-head far more often.
Yeah, so there's, you know, players like Bianca Andreescu, who I think is a wonderful tennis player from Canada, who beat Serena in the U.S. Open Finals, been off the radar because of injury.
Mm.
She's got that kind of charisma. So, I mean, there are people that can surface, but you're going to need that. You're not going to probably get Chris Evert versus Martina Navratilova or Roger Rafa Novak triangle, but you could certainly get a lot better than it is now. And I think that's maybe where Ash will shine over time as a personality who wears well, but she needs people to kind of rub up against her to see where you stand with her, I think.
Mm. Yeah, she's got that edge too that you can't sort of outwardly see, but she can sort of just how do I best describe it? You know, when there's a real pressure moment, when she's been challenged, I mean, every athlete's got it. I mean, you don't get to world number one if you haven't got some real grunt and steel about you to seize those big moments. But if you're just looking outwardly, trying to sort of assess that, you can't quite see it. But then if you know sort of Barty and the way she goes about it, if you sort of watch her train and you just watch her around the corridors, we see more intimate environment, you know, I've seen her come into media and she can be quite, let's go, let's get this done. It's just, there's an edge there that every top athlete has got to have on the court and then dealing with, you know, just being in the spotlight. But it doesn't necessarily always shine through. You can't always see that.
Yeah, you know a lot better than I do, Brad. You've been around her, I'm sure, more than I have. But my sense of it is that there is a gap between public and private Birdie, which is pretty wide.
Yes.
I think she's a lot probably more fun and humorous and sort of expansive. And, you know, obviously the popularity she has in the locker room, it's extraordinary. I mean, the people always have a certain reaction when a player wins a slam. It's, you know, it's a nice – but this is over the top in a way. People are really coming out of the woodwork saying how happy they are for her among her peers on the tour. That tells you that she's somebody that they really gravitate to. And I don't think she's shown that kind of warm and charismatic side to the general public yet. And as she matures and realizes where she's comfortable and where she's not, maybe that'll come out more. That'd be good, I think. It'd be good for the sport and maybe good for her even to kind of get if I'm right, have those two parts of her harmonize more, you know?
No doubt. Well, I noticed it just even working with Sam. I've, you know, met Sam and interviewed Sam Stosur a lot over the journey, but we haven't actually sat together and commentated. And she's definitely one that's really come out of her shell in the second half of her her career. She's got more comfortable of the person she is and just her, you know, her place, I suppose, in tennis. And it's great to see, you know, these young athletes, particularly in tennis, who come in so young. And just to watch them evolve as human beings, we've seen, you know, so many of the great champions be one version, then sort of be the elder statesman where they're great to deal with, sort of beyond 30. Like, you know, an Agassi, for example, who was always compelling to listen to any time he stepped in front of a microphone from the brash days to the real statesman days.
Yeah, we were talking before you came on about Medvedev and how it'll be interesting to see how he develops as a character in the public eye and how his personality evolves. And it's true of all these wonderful players that there's going to be a change. The fact that your life changes that much, the fact that you're given that forum and that platform, it does change you. And so it's a matter of how you choose to go with it. I just feel like with Ash, we're not seeing the whole Ash Birdie at this point yet in the public eye. That's my sense. So what you don't want is someone not to be authentic to themselves. I don't think that's the way to be happy or to play your best tennis even. So hopefully Ash, as time goes on, will find where she feels good about sharing. And obviously she had a point in her career, Brett, is when she backed off the sport altogether, partly because she didn't like, you know, the vibe of it and what it was doing to her. So she clearly came back to the sport in 2016 with a kind of a new set of a new roadmap, if you will, for how to handle it. And she's still following that. And who can argue? I mean, 3-0 Grand Slam finals and WTA finals champion, number one in the world for a lot of weeks. So it's working for her.
Oh, she's a beautiful tennis player. And, you know, you go back to when it all started. That game style was developed so young. You know, Jim Joyce and the work he did, and it's just a beautiful thing to watch. I could watch it every day of the week. 0433981116 on the text. Keep your thoughts coming through during the evening as we head towards 7:30 when the players, just after 7:30, will make their way out onto Rod Laver Arena. I've been thinking about this today. Chris, I know you discussed it a little bit earlier with Jordan. I mean, my heart clearly and unashamedly is with Nadal tonight to win a 21st, to win an Australian Open for the second time for, you know, the legend that he has been and all the trips that he's made, 17 appearances here in Australia. But, boy, oh boy, you wouldn't begrudge Medvedev either. So I sort of still like the older guys having their presence and still winning majors, but you want to see a few of these guys now, and he's one that can get a couple under his belt. You know, Tsitsipas hasn't won, Zverev hasn't won, Berrettini hasn't won, and Rublev, et cetera, et cetera. So you want to start to see these guys build some majors, but the perfect end to what has been the most unusual build-up. It's almost like we've sort of just forgotten all about that. I'm going to get your thoughts on that. There'll be more to play out, clearly, the whole Djokovic thing, is Barty, Nadal as the two winners. That's the perfect script.
That would be a good... I'm always amazed, as I was saying to Jordan before, too, a little bit just... These guys have won so much, the Nadals and Federer's, and Djokovic pre-Australia issues, I would say. There's still a lot of guys who want them to win out there. There's a lot of support for them as champions. People aren't tired of them yet in that way, you know. So it's really interesting to me that that's still the case. It says a lot about the way they've conducted themselves in general. But the Novak thing has been really on the back burner, which has been interesting to see. It tells you how compelling the tournament's been and how tired everybody was of the subject, I think. Yeah. But now it comes back into play, because if Medvedev wins this match, you can't help but notice he never had to go through Novak, and the number one ranking is now going to be basically in play if Medvedev wins tonight.
Correct.
And that wouldn't have happened maybe if Novak were here. So it's there are some things that are going to be a little more directly related to that than there have been in a while.
What do you think will be sort of the narrative post Australian Open? I mean, Tennis Australia will no doubt hear on the ground, go through their own review as they always do, but maybe more forensically to look at how things unfolded. I just wonder how much is going to still play out here and how this is going to linger, how long this is going to linger, the whole Djokovic situation.
Well, certainly the way the tournament played out, being successful on the court and the Barty story and all that, and the Kyrgios-Kokkinakis and the all-Aussie doubles finals and this great matchup here tonight, I mean, it really couldn't have gone maybe better in terms of the storylines once Novak was gone.
Yep.
So that can't hurt. But I do think it's important that everybody does a thorough review because the Australian Open has worked so hard to get its status as an equal partner with the other three Grand Slams.
Mm.
And they have really succeeded, I think, in a lot of ways in that. So you don't want to lose or step back from that status because of a series of problems that people start to perceive as an issue with governance or an issue with you know, the way the tournament is handling itself in this new era that we're all in. So I think there's some important choices and also important messages to send in the coming weeks ahead of before it's all forgotten in the wider sense. And I trust Australian officials to do that.
Yep.
But I think it's important to do it.
Yes. No, I totally agree. But, it's 2 weeks can go very quickly in someone's life. And, I mean, when you're working big days here at the Australian Open, 2 weeks feels like a month. It's just hard to even think back now as to that whole build-up, which was just crazy, really. But thankfully, we've been able to just focus on the tennis, which we love, and we've got a great script with Barty last night. And Rafa, regardless, we're going to have a quality men's final, and that's what we always want. We've had plenty of them over the years. There haven't been too many men's finals that have generally sort of disappointed. I mean, we had, when Djokovic cleaned up Nadal here, was that about an hour and a half or something like that? It was a total decimation. But generally speaking, we've had some great finals.
Yeah, the last one was not, but the context was amazing. So I think that was that made up for it in a way. I mean, Novak and Daniil was a straight set victory for Medvedev, but it was kind of a surprisingly lopsided result.
Mm.
So I think that kind of grabbed the attention. There was so much at stake. But tonight I'd be very surprised if it was not tight. But I got to wonder, you know, Nadal is such a champion and is such a guy who will give everything he has and dig into the deepest part of himself for these big matches. But I just got to wonder how much he has in the tank against a young guy who has so much shot tolerance and seems like he's just playing pretty loosely and pretty confidently and knows how to handle Rafa and the whole Rafa aura out there.
We know that he just blitzes through his service games. I mean, he's up there serving. I mean, Rafa likes to play at his own pace.
Mm.
And Daniil will hurry you all the time. And then, on the return games, I mean, his movement, anticipation, those bullet returns. So there's going to be a lot of pressure on Nadal. I'm just fascinated to see the game plan of how he attacks Daniil. But, Rafa, at the same time, has been really, really convincing. He's just had the eyes of someone that has eyed. This is a great opportunity. Novak's not here. This is maybe my window to claim in a second Australian Open. So I think he is clearly right in this match tonight, even though everyone, I think just generally speaking, talking to people around the traps, feels like Medvedev is just going to wear him down like he's wear down everyone else. But it's all in front of us.
Well, I think it'd be interesting for people to watch tonight just to watch Nadal's forehand.
Yep.
I think that'll be really interesting to see. That's Rafa's tell shot. That's what he depends on to construct points and demolish points. And against a lot of players, as we saw against Berrettini, semifinal, that can just be too much. And he broke down Berrettini's back end. This situation here tonight, playing against a right-hander, a lot of things that Rafa does usually to dominate matches are not going to work.
Yep.
Because Medvedev loves that backhand at all different heights. He can hit incredible shots with it from deep points in the court, extreme angles from that side of the court.
Mm.
So the inside-out forehands and the inside-in forehands that Rafa depends on, he's going to run into some serious resistance defensively, and also somebody who can really attack him quickly with flat shots in response at 6'6". So that'll be a real key matchup, that shot, against whatever Medvedev defends it with.
All that ahead of us tonight. Chris, you've been outstanding. It's been great to have you in the box just to pick your brain, to get your insights. We love reading all your work in the New York Times. And when do you fly out?
hey, I got to test negative tomorrow.
Right.
Assuming it's all going to go well, I'm leaving Tuesday, sadly. It's been great to be back in Melbourne. I really enjoyed being with you guys, Brett.
Yeah, it's been good fun.
A treat for me, and it's really a special place you have here.
I might catch you at Indian Wells. Got to make a call on that.
Yeah. I feel like you want to catch me in Europe, sounds like more.
I do. Yeah, I do want to get on the plane and just get a little bit closer to the epicentre of tennis once it leaves our shores in January. Christopher Cleary, great to have the mind of one of the best tennis journalists going around. You can follow Chris on Twitter, of course, and read all his great work in the New York Times online right throughout the year. We're going to take a break. Mark Woodford, Jordan Canellis are going to come in and join you to take you through the next little half hour as I step back out on court, and the players will be with us in the next 35 minutes. There'll be the light show, there'll be a presentation, a performance and the national anthem, and all the usual things that go on before a big final. Nadal and Medvedev coming up in about half an hour. Plenty more to come. Stick with us. 0433 98 11 16. Keep your texts coming through as we build up to Medvedev and Nadal.
Welcome back to SEN's coverage of the Australian Open 2022, brought to you by the super fast charging all-electric Kia EV6. Brett Phillips is out. I've tagged back in. Chris Cleary is out. Mark Woodford's going to tag in just a moment, and he'll be with you for the rest of the night analysing our match as our special comments expert. Thanks to Nilex retractable hose reels, water like a Nile expert, available at Bunnings. We'll speak to him in just a moment. So we are in the final hour now, within the hour of this men's singles final, kicking off between the number 2 seed from Russia, Daniil Medvedev, and the number 6 seed from Spain, Rafael Nadal. History on the line for Rafael Nadal tonight, bidding to win just his second Grand Slam title as well, which is incredible as he is obviously the champion that he is. But 2009, so that's 13 years ago for Rafael Nadal that he won the Oz Open title. I actually watched the post-match ceremony of that from 2009 a couple of nights ago, and Roger Federer was in tears that night. Rafael Nadal was still a baby-faced competitor, and you could tell at that time his English wasn't quite strong enough, not as strong as it is now, and very magnanimous, both of them, from their results on that occasion that night. But that was 2009, Rafael Nadal. Now tonight he has the chance to win slam number 21 and to go ahead of the rest, be the man on top of the mountain, and claim history for himself. Daniil Medvedev is the one who's trying to spoil the party. He has experience in doing that. He did it last year at the final major of the 2021 calendar year when he defeated Novak Djokovic in the US Open men's finals. So he knows how to do it. And having a slam title under his belt as well is a huge thing. He spoke in the pre-tournament press conference heading into the Oz Open here, Daniil Medvedev, about how much winning a slam, how much extra confidence winning a slam gives you, and the things that he wasn't, things that he used to worry about earlier before he won the title in the US, he doesn't quite worry about now. He knows he's got that inner belief now that he can do it. So some of those doubts just fly away when you're a slam champion. So that's just a little brief snippet of what we have coming up for you in the matter of about 40 or so minutes, half an hour, depending on how long the all the pre-match ceremonies go for, which will kick off in just a moment. Rod Laver Arena is beginning to fill up now. The gates are open and the patrons are filing in. The lights are low, the blue lights are on, to give this suspenseful feel around centre court here at Melbourne Park. Jordan Canellis with you, our expert for the match tonight, sitting alongside Brett Phillips for the majority of this encounter, is 17-time Slam champion in the doubles and mixed doubles, Mark Woodford. Mark, welcome back. Good to see you again.
Sorry, I've lost my pen down here to take all these notes. All these nuggets that you're providing, that's going to help me to call the match as well.
We're in a dark, small, cramped space as well.
I have found one pen.
Good luck.
So. I'm good. How are you doing, Jordan? You really looking forward to this one?
Yeah.
I mean, it is... boy. 21. Are you hoping that he could make 21?
I kind of am. I think as much as I do love Daniil Medvedev, and I would love to see him win here, and I'm sure he will win in Oz one day, but I would... maybe just for purely selfish reasons, I would love to see the 21st Grand Slam achieved here on this court.
Exactly, here. It would be just something. And I don't know, do we overplay the fact that he's only won once, one time here? He's had a couple of opportunities along the way, but this is his least winningest Grand Slam.
Yeah, Nadal. I was actually, so I think
the statistician Josh Kay put up a little graphic on Twitter earlier and comparing the numbers, so splitting off the titles won at each slam from the big three, Djokovic, yep. Federer, Nadal. And most of them have only won one on their weakest surface, so or their weakest slam.
The weakest
so,
link, yeah.
So Nadal's only won one here. Federer's only won one at the French, and I think Djokovic's weakest is two at the French, I reckon. But he's probably got the most even spread, Novak Djokovic. He's won sort of multiple across an even sort of layer across all four slams. So Federer and Nadal have just the one at their respective weak slams, and this is the one for Rafael Nadal. So yeah, there's going to be that kind of that sort of omen maybe looming over at Rafa tonight.
He played the spoiler at the US Open, Medvedev, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that his design is to be a spoiler once again this evening and end up with his second Grand Slam.
The match tonight, is it the perfect way to finish this Oz Open? This fortnight that we've had, even longer than a fortnight, you go back the week earlier to qualifying and the week that we had off the court as well, leading into this with Novak Djokovic, to see where, you know, how far we've come from then to now and the tournament we've had and all the great highlights. Is this the best way to finish it off?
I'm not sure that there would be one other appropriate player to be playing. Look, the number two seed, he's in the final. So, mm-hmm. But I think perfectly positioned with Rafa Nadal. I don't know if there is anyone else in the draw that, or another two, that comes to mind. I mean, Zverev obviously went out early. Apart from an Australian maybe that might have snuck through, but I think this is the perfect end of the 2022 Australian Open to have these two play off in the final and what it means. Both are trying to achieve significant, by capturing the title, significant achievements. Obviously, title 21 for Nadal, but for Medvedev, the possibility of climbing to number one?
It feels like any other final, it sort of has to be, I don't know, to make the anatomy of a final. I don't know, what makes a good final? I guess in this recent era, one of the big three or two of the big three making it is always going to be box office. Daniil Medvedev, though, being the top-ranked player in the draw now, active player in the draw, and Rafael Nadal still feels like a great end to this tournament. If another player had made it, not to be disrespectful or to denigrate the other players, but it feels like, oh, yeah, it would have been a good final, it would have been good, but this feels like it has the possibility to be a great final, particularly after what they did at the US in 2019. That was a long match. Fingers crossed, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like this is kind of a great way to end it off. The tournament on the whole. So for the last 2 weeks we've had and what we've observed and the highlights we've had, the lowlights, which have been, there's been a few, but it's been not that many actually once the tournament got underway. The running of the tournament this year and what we've had on court, are you leaving satisfied?
No, because I think we could do better in the fact that moving forward ahead in say 12 months' time, you know, hopefully we are in a different position, our world. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, getting back to 100%, I felt like the AO in the first week was flat, really flat. Lack of crowds. I think their controversy with Djokovic marred the beginning of the tournament. Mm-hmm. I think there was hesitation maybe with fans, but it has bounced back strongly. I think the excitement of Ash Barty, the tremendous focus and spotlight on the 2Ks and doubles, I feel like it has bounced back and has fed our appetite, definitely. But I think we can do better when the crowds are at max capacity.
I agree. I think we're all buoyed by the second week we've had. The second week has been good. The matches that we've had in prime time have been excellent, and the results that we're getting at the back end of the tournament have been great as well. There didn't really seem to be many first week, so just talking about purely about the tennis, there wasn't too many first week classics. Normally you will get a long match on the men's or the women's side that sets the tone in the first week and is the landmark match of the first or the second or the third round, but we didn't quite have that this year.
No, nothing jumps out at me.
there was a couple, you know, there's always five setters, but there wasn't one that goes, oh, that's a classic night session that runs into 2 a.m.
We had a couple of days that were on the men's side that went, you know, a number of matches that certainly pushed to the limit of five sets. Mm-hmm. But there was nothing of, say, the excitement of someone outside of 250 or a wild card or someone that's come through qualifying that caused a boil over along the way. Well, we had one late night finish. But
we had, there's two I can remember. We had
a two, was it a 2:30?
Day. Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, we had one very late one, which was Manorino and Karatsev.
Yes.
And then we had Karatsev and Muna in the first or second round, I think that was, which was about 12:30 on Kia Arena. And then Karatsev Manorino on Margaret Court went to about 2:30. Yeah, those were kind of the two, but they don't sort of jump out, I guess, as they kind of, that, it felt like they were hidden away a little bit. The crowd situation, so having been capped at 50% through the first week and a half-ish, was there anything, do you think that was the right approach for Tennis Australia to take to cap the crowds, or should we have been allowed to be at full capacity from the start?
I don't believe that it was probably their choice. I think, you know, in consultation, you know, that's what our media releases are saying, that, you know, after they petitioned, you know, for the Victorian government to heighten the caps. So I think that was probably what was imposed by them. I think the tournament could have increased it in the first week as well, but that's heading into a different direction and story topic altogether.
Yeah. So the hope is obviously back to absolute full capacity for next year's tournament. It'd be remarkable if we weren't at that stage, to be honest.
It would be a kick in the pants, and I think for it would be a heavy imposition for Tennis Australia as well. That the impact financially of the tournament last year and this year, it's a heavy toll. And if they have to go through a third year, they would want to have the financial aid and support and guarantee by the Victorian government as well as the federal government.
Ash Barty's triumph last night will be the watershed moment of this Oz Open 2022. Even regardless of what happens tonight, I feel, especially from an Australian perspective, this will be remembered as Ash Barty's year. The final last night, I don't know if you've had a chance to recap it on radio at all, Mark, to our audiences, but from what you observed in the final last night, Ash Barty and Danielle Collins, it was a tight two-setter. I think we all would have been racked with nerves, even more so than what we were had it gone to three, but Ash somehow pulled it out from nowhere, from two breaks down, and I'm still trying to fathom how she did that in the second set. And also, by the same token, how Danielle Collins let go of such a strong lead where she had Ash Barty on the back foot at 5-1 in the second set.
Well, unfortunately for Danielle Collins, to get off to that start, stay neck and neck, and then allowed Ash to take control. I think she became a bit pensive, given the occasion as well, for her first time competing for a Grand Slam final. So I think Ash was moving along very well towards the end of the first set, but a light went off for Danielle Collins. Mm. The reason that she was here into the final was because of the emotional involvement, investment that she showed us and displayed through each of those matches. And then she got down on the ground and the fist pumps came and the cries of come on. And even when Ash Barty was making a mistake, there was this cry coming out from Danielle Collins' end of the court. That's how she has been. That's how she is. And that's how she then took the match by its throat. But it disappeared. She stopped doing it at 5-1. I'm not sure if she just got tired, that the whole fortnight caught up with her, but she lost control of that match. And again, she went through a flat patch and Ash started to just change her game slightly. She started to go out after Danielle Collins' second serve, which is something that Danielle Collins had been doing to her in order to build that 5-1 lead. So Yeah, it was just a real change of momentum, and it got a little close there, in the tiebreaker, to the tiebreaker. But I think then the occasion really got to Danielle. But certainly for me, when she stopped, when she just lost her way with the war cry for herself and to the crowd, that's where she lost it.
Ash's ability to problem solve halfway through that second set, and you mentioned how she changed her game a little bit. It was clear, this was the hardest game for Ash, and to be expected in the final. She hadn't really been challenged at all throughout her run. The toughest match she had was against Amanda Anisimova, which went 6-4, 6-3, and Ash looked reasonably comfortable in that match as well. A few little tweaks here and there against the big-hitting Anisimova, but last night, the slice backhand wasn't really Ash's weapon. It had been her weapon all the way throughout the tournament, all the way throughout the last two or three years for Ash, but last night it wasn't really doing its job because Danielle Collins was able to overpower it. But then, as you said, Ash went back after Collins and the forehand became the weapon. And the ability to problem solve that and go from, all right, the backhand, which is my normal craft, not working as well as I want it to, let's go with the forehand and go for try and attack Danielle Collins.
There was a period, though, the backhand slice just started to float. It didn't have any weight of shot. So I don't think she just relied on the forehand. I think she worked out on the sidelines, motioning to her team as well that she needed to pick up a bit of the weight of shot. And I think from maybe 4-1, 5-1, it just started to combine with going through a flat trough for Danielle Collins. That's where Ash started to pick up that weight of shot. And but she still, she used a different part of her game, and that's the beauty of Ash Barty. A lot of those other girls out there, Madison Keys and even Danielle Collins, if they're not playing their A game well, there's just no B game. And Ash has a B level and a C level. Maybe there's a D level, but she can problem solve.
That's Mark Woodford. We'll hear his voice throughout the course of the night as our special comments expert in the men's singles final. Rafael Nadal and Daniil Medvedev, we are building up. We're within about 20-25 minutes away from this match kicking off. Nadal, the number 6 seed from Spain. Medvedev, the number 2 seed from Russia. SEN's coverage of the Oz Open brought to you by the super fast charging all-electric Kia EV6. We'll take a break and we'll continue the build-up on the other side of this. Welcome back to SEN's coverage of the Australian Open, brought to you by the super fast charging all-electric Kia EV6, our major partner here on SEN's coverage of the Oz Open and a major partner with the Oz Open itself. And it's a pleasure to have the CEO from Kia, Damien Meredith, here on SEN's coverage. Damien, good evening.
Thank you for having me.
Damien, has it been another satisfying tournament for you and Kia this year at the Oz Open?
It's been a huge success. Obviously, everyone's aware of the rocky road that we started with, but the tennis has been fantastic. The crowds have been magnificent, and the ratings have been out of this world. So we're very happy that of what's happened this year with the 2022 Australian Open.
Does the partnership continue to reach new highs year on year on year at Kia?
It does, and we've used the Australian Open to launch new cars over the last 5 years, and that's worked very, very well for us. So with what's occurred this year, there's obviously we've got Kia Arena, we've got a new entertainment area for our dealers and guests. So the whole thing's come together exceptionally well.
And for you personally, Damien, what's been the highlight for this Oz Open 2022 for you?
Oh, I think last night was a great highlight, not only for me, but for all Australia. Incredible what Ash Barty's achieved, and that second set, 1-5 down, fights back, and wins in two was pretty spectacular and something I don't think I'll ever forget.
Damien, it's a pleasure speaking to you tonight, and enjoy the men's final. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Damien Meredith, the Chief Operating Officer at Kia, who's been our presenting partner throughout the last 2 weeks here on SEN's coverage of the Oz Open and also the major sponsor of the Oz Open itself. We are into the countdown now here at Rod Laver Arena. The light show is on
at centre court as the crowd continues to file in. It's mostly full now, Rod Laver Arena, to watch this sound and lights show with all the spotlights lighting up the different sections of the court, covered lights being beamed around to all different corners of RLA and patterns being drawn on the ground from the lighting rig. So it's quite the spectacle with all the LED screens as well, with the imagery of champions from Oz Open's past complementing the light show at Rod Laver Arena. Jordan Canellis and Mark Woodford with you here in the bunker, watching on, being dazzled by the sound and lights in front of us. It's really stimulating the senses, isn't it, Mark?
I'm in awe. Can we just pause and watch this?
That's unbelievable. It's, try and feed
I know it. That's not perfect for radio, but it is something to behold. They have done a phenomenal job. When they first brought in this LED advertising, I mean, everyone now, they're a real leader, the AO, as far as pre-match shows on finals day. Well, every night session.
I was just thinking the other day how well the Oz Open has branded itself. So thinking about, I think when the old logo went out, the old orange and blue logo with the silhouette of the man serving, it's, you know, whenever you see a logo that's been around like that, you know, been, you know, change, everyone goes, oh, I love the logo. But the logo that they've brought in now is very modern. It's been around for a couple of years now, the AO, very simplified. But just in general, the branding of the tournament itself, from how strong the colour scheme is, which is such a simple, almost trivial thing, but everyone knows the AO blue, the courts are the blue, the logo is the same blue, and just everything, the imagery around it, it's been branded so well. And it's, I don't know what the personal experience is like at other Grand Slams. I mean, Wimbledon has its own branding and its own image as well. But I think the Oz Open image has been established so well, and people just know what it is when you see it.
They certainly do. And for me, it's a bit more of a younger, it's more hip logo, and the way that they promote it here. You know, Wimbledon's very traditional. US Open, I think, you know, don't quite reach what we have achieved here with our promotion, and certainly with, you know, this enclosed RLA arena. And I mean, that's what makes, you know, our slam probably the best slam. And I say that with all sincerity. I know it's my own home slam, but it really has taken, come on leaps and bounds. And I think when you hear players talk about today's players, that they just love coming down here. I mean, they are so well taken care of, and it's you know, pretty special to be an Australian who has played here before, and knowing that everyone is gravitating to come back, itching to get back here.
Speaking of Kia, and again, we thank Damien Meredith for joining us, but the new Kia Arena, you're a fan of it? Did you manage to pop in a couple of times, or at least see the matches played on that court?
That's one of the area here that I have not gone and actually sat into. Usually I like to go to, you know, that court and a court and, you know, just sit down and take it in. But I have not ventured over there as yet. Have I got time? What time's the final starting?
You might be able to jump over there for a couple of minutes.
Can you handle this?
I can pad for a bit. Yeah, no, if you haven't been there, anyone who hasn't been there, it's a fantastic stadium. I normally like to get around to each stadium once. I didn't actually get to John Cain this year, which is a surprise, because that's normally been the court where everything happens. But Kia felt like it had a slow start, but in the second week, and particularly with the continuation of Kyrgios and Kokkinakis in the doubles progressing through each stage, it became slowly almost the new or another version of Show Court 3, which has been established as the Aussie court. All the Aussies get scheduled out there for the ground pass holders at Show Court 3, and Kia is just a bigger version. I don't know how many people are Show Court 3 holds, probably 1,000 or 2,000, but Kia's 5,000, so it's a bigger version of that. And and it became another bigger court for the people.
It certainly has. And you know, we have, just trying to think of the other, you know, Wimbledon with the two courts, covered courts, and their plans are long term. They've bought the land across on the golf course side, and so there will be another grand court over there, but it's going to take some time. Roland Garros will have a roof over Suzanne Longland in years to come, pre-Olympic Games. I think US Open is really built out, but we have continued to evolve.
Yeah. Speaking of Kyrgios and Kokkinakis, last night you were there to present to them the trophies, or the trophy that they won, viewing their final last night, and you were with us for the semi-final as well. The tone of Kyrgios and Kokkinakis was very serious, I noticed. It was very light-hearted, and they were the showmen out on Kia Arena. But when they stepped into Rod Laver for the semis and for the final, they sort of knuckled down. I think they became very serious about winning the title. Is there a sense of pride or a sense of just awe in how they were actually able to go out and win that final last night?
Yes, I'm in awe. I mean, I was over the moon to see, you know, four Australians battle it out for the doubles title. And I think it should be serious for them. It's a Grand Slam. It's a chance to be called a Grand Slam champion. So I felt like in their semi-finals that they, out here on RLA, they toned it down somewhat. I'm okay with getting, you know, overly excited and jumping around and on top of each other and, you know, enjoying the moment. It's the racket breaking sometimes and the watching Jim Courier and Rod Laver come out to with the trophy, and I kind of wonder why Jim Courier is out there carrying it. Rod Laver, I understand. Year's significance for Jim Courier?
What year did Jim Courier win it? It was 96, or was it a bit earlier than that? Not an anniversary of his win, was it?
Well, just wonder, is there a need? If unless it is an anniversary, then, you know, that's very apt to have him out there.
It is 1992. So there you go.
Okay.
30 years.
So same with Todd and I winning the doubles title. So there we go. Yeah.
There you are.
So sorry, I'm just, you know.
No, right to
it is
everything.
Our Australian Open. So
yeah, well, as an American holding it. No, it's been brought out, the Norman Brooks Challenge Cup, sitting in the middle of the court on its plinth. And let's head into RLA now for the national anthem.
Australians, oh, let us rejoice, for we are one and free. We've golden soil and wealth of toil, our home is girt by sea. Our land abounds in nature's gifts of beauty rich and rare. In history's page, let every stage advance Australia fair. In joyful strains, and let us sing, advance Australia fair.
Rob Mills singing Advance Australia Fair in the pre-match to Rafael Nadal and Daniil Medvedev in the men's singles final. We'll quickly take a break here on SEN's coverage of the Oz Open. When we come back after this, Mark Woodford will analyse what's going to happen in the match. Brett Phillips will be in shortly to commentate the match as well. That's next on SEN's coverage of the Oz Open for 2022. We are in the final minutes now ahead of the men's singles final from Rod Laver Arena. The number 6 seed from Spain, Rafael Nadal, the raging bull, going for the record. The record achieving 21st Grand Slam to go ahead of Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. At the other end of the court is the number 2 seed from Russia, Daniil Medvedev, the leader of the new brigade in tennis. With one slam title under his belt, can he be the first man in men's singles history in the Open era to win the next Grand Slam after achieving his first? No one has won two consecutive Grand Slams as their two
first slams in their career, one after the other, from the US Open last year to the Oz Open at the start of this year. Jordan Canellis with you. Our expert for this men's singles final is Mark Woodford. Thanks to Nilex retractable hose reels, water like a Nile expert, available at Bunnings. The text line is 0433 98 11 16 if you'd like to get involved throughout the course of the evening with myself and Mark. And Brett, when he comes in, Brett Phillips will be calling the action for you once he has concluded his on-court announcing duties. All the stars are in the crowd as well. The cameras are picking out Eric Banner at the moment. There's a lot more others as well that will be in there, I'm sure, for this significant occasion at Rod Laver Arena. Medvedev, 25 years old. Nadal, 35 years old. Does it feel... So it's a men's singles final, and it's the final night, so we all wait in anticipation here for this match, Mark. But does it feel like we've eased a little bit? Do we feel more comfortable? I feel like a lot of Australia's emotional investment went into last night. And because we had that emotional release with Ash Barty winning, I feel lighter tonight heading into tonight's final.
Less nervous?
Far less nervous than last night, for sure. For me, anyway, I'm speaking personally.
Oh, look, this was 40 plus years since we last had a female champion. And, you know, Ash got it done finally. And so, but for me, I think the way men's tennis has come about over the last, well, this last part of the last 6 months, let's say, you know, this is a massive match. I think, you know, we shouldn't, you know, underestimate the potential here for Rafa Nadal. He goes to Grand Slam 21. I mean, that tunes into being called arguably the greatest player ever. I mean, his stats stand up. He should be called the greatest player ever, in my opinion. And, you know, if Medvedev stands tall here and wins back-to-back Grand Slams, moves to number one. I mean, I think then, you know, we're transitioning. There are all these possibilities, these pathways with, you know, having these two titans play off against each other. I am super anticipating a royal battle out here, or battle royale.
Battle royale. Is there a measure or a numeric that can be, that you can use to split Nadal from Djokovic and Federer?
Winning 21 Grand Slams is it.
That's it?
Yeah.
Comes down to that?
For me, I look at, you know, there's arguments for Federer. There's arguments for Djokovic as well. And I think it's, ultimately, it's the Grand Slams where history is made. And history could be made tonight.
Rafael Nadal and Daniil Medvedev are making their way down the Walk of Legends. Rafael Nadal has his purple tracksuit jacket on. Daniil Medvedev all in white. Rafa's got his mask on and racket in his left hand. Now they trudge down with all the names of previous winners from both men's and women's over either shoulder as they come through the hall. They turn the corner and they'll wait at the door to be announced on court, and we'll hear the roar in just a moment. The strengths and weaknesses of these two gentlemen are perfectly poised against one another. There's a good balance between the two. The last two singles finals, so tonight and last night's women's singles final, had a nice balance of opposites. Danielle Collins was the brutaliser. She was the louder of the two competitors. Ash Barty was the more artful, crafty player. Opposites. Tonight, it's similar kind of players who predominantly like to play on the baseline, but Rafael Nadal will attack from the start. Daniil Medvedev will defend from the start. So from that sense, you have opposites. We'll expand on that in just a second. Let's get some noise. Rafael Nadal is coming out onto Rod Laver Arena now.
It's Tyre Power's Big Footy Final Sale. To kick things off, you can get the power to buy three and get one free on selected Toyo passenger car and SUV tyres. Tyre Power's Big Footy Final Sale can't last. Visit tyrepower.com.au now.